I wrap my arms tight around him and start singing. I shot the sheriff, but I didn't shoot the deputy. Jacob's hands are flapping so hard that he's bruising me. Talk to me, I say. Did something happen with Jess? At the sound of her name, he arches backward, as if he's been pierced by a bullet. He starts smacking his head against the wall so hard that it dents the plaster. Don't, I beg, using every bit of strength I have to drag him forward so that he can't hurt himself. Dealing with an autistic meltdown is like dealing with a tornado. Once you're close enough to see it coming, there's nothing to do but weather the storm. Unlike a child having a temper tantrum, Jacob doesn't care if his behavior is making me react. He doesn't make sure he's not hurting himself. He isn't doing it in order to get something. In fact, he's not in control of himself at all. And unlike when he was 4 or 5, I'm not big enough to control him anymore. I get up and turn off all the lights in the room and pull down the blackout shade so that it's dark. I put on his Marley CD. Then I start pulling clothes off the hangers in his closet and pile them on his body, which at first makes him scream harder, and then, as the weight builds, calms him down. By the time he falls asleep in my arms, I've ripped my blouse and my stockings. The CD has repeated 4 times in its entirety. The LED display on his alarm clock reads 8:35 p.m. What set you off? I whisper. It could have been anything. An argument with Jess, or the fact that he didn't like the layout of the kitchen and her new accommodations, or the realization too late that he was missing his favorite TV show. I kiss Jacob on the forehead. Then, gently, I disengage myself from the knot of his arms and leave him curled on the floor with a pillow under his head. I cover him with the rainbow postage stamp summertime quilt that's been folded up for the season in his closet. Muscles stiff, I walk downstairs again. The lights have all been turned off, except for one in the kitchen. Let's go out for Chinese tonight. But that was before I knew that I would be sucked into the black hole that Jacob can become at any given moment. There's a cereal bowl on the counter, with a puddle of soy milk still in the bottom. The Rice Chex box stands beside it like an accusation. Motherhood is a Sisyphean task. You finish sewing one seam shut, and another rips open. I've come to believe that this life I'm wearing will never really fit. I carry the bowl to the sink and swallow the tears that spring to the back of my throat. Oh, Theo, I'm so sorry. Again.
This ends Disc 3. House Rules, Disc 4.
Case 3. Bragged, taunted, caught. Dennis Rader was a married man with 2 grown children, a former Cub Scout leader, and president of his Lutheran church. He also, after a 31-year investigation, was revealed to be the serial killer known as BTK, short for Bind, Torture, and Kill. His method for murdering 10 people in the Wichita, Kansas area between 1974 and 1991. After the killings, letters were sent to the police bragging of the killings and offering grisly details. Following a 25-year silence, those letters and packages resumed in 2004, claiming responsibility for a murder for which he had not been suspected. DNA was taken from beneath the fingernails of a victim, and authorities gathered 1,100 DNA samples, attempting to find the serial killer. In one of BTK's communications, a computer disk mailed to KSAS-TV, metadata from the Microsoft Word document revealed that the author was someone named Dennis, as well as a link to the Lutheran Church. Searching on the internet, police were able to find a suspect, Dennis Rader. By obtaining his daughter's DNA and comparing it with DNA samples found on the victims, the police were able to make a familial match, giving them enough probable cause for arrest. He has been sentenced to 175 years to life. So, to all of you who surf for internet porn or spend your free time writing anarchist manifestos, beware. You can't ever really get rid of something on your computer.
Chapter 3. Rich. I've faced down a lot of harrowing situations in my 20 years on the job. Suicides in progress, felons on the run after an armed robbery, rape victims too traumatized to tell me their story. None of these, however, compare to having to work an audience made up of 7-year-olds.
"Can you show us your gun again?" one kid asks.
"Not a great idea," I say, glancing at the teacher, who already asked me to remove my holster and weapon before coming into the class for job day, a request I had to refuse, since technically I was still on the clock.
"Do you get to shoot it?"
I look over the ammo-obsessed boy's head at the rest of the class. "Any other questions?" A little girl raises her hand. I recognize her. She might have come to one of Sasha's birthday parties.
"Do you always get the bad guys?"
she asks. There's no way to explain to a child that the line between good and evil isn't nearly as black and white as a fairy tale would lead you to believe. That an ordinary person can turn into a villain under the right circumstances. That sometimes we dragon slayers do things we aren't proud of. I look her in the eye. "We sure try," I say. On my hip, my cell phone starts to vibrate. I flip it open, see the number of the station, and stand up. "I'm going to have to cut this short, so one more time, what's the number one rule of crime scenes?" The class sings the answer back to me.
"Don't touch something wet if it's not from you."
As the teacher asks them all to thank me with a round of applause, I crouch down near Sasha's desk. "What do you think? Did I embarrass you beyond repair?"
"You did okay,"
she says. "I can't stay to have lunch with you," I apologize. "I have to go down to the station."
"That's all right, Daddy,"
Sasha shrugs.
"I'm used to it."
The hell with a bullet. What kills me is disappointing my kid. I kiss her on the crown of her head and let the teacher walk me to the door. Then I drive right to the station and get a quick briefing from the sergeant who took the original complaint. Mark McGuire, a UVM graduate student, is slouching in the waiting room. He's wearing a baseball cap pulled low over his face and is bouncing his leg up and down nervously. I watch him for a second through the window before I head out to meet him. "Mr. McGuire," I say, "I'm Detective Mattson. What can I do for you?" He stands up. "A girlfriend's missing." "Missing?" I repeat. "Yeah. I called her last night, and there was no answer. And this morning, when I went to her place, she was gone." "When was the last time you saw her?" "Tuesday morning," Mark says. "Could there have been some emergency or an appointment she didn't tell you about?" "No. She never goes anywhere without her purse, and it was still in the house, along with her coat. It's freezing out. Why would she have gone somewhere without her coat?" His voice is wild, worried. "You two have a fight?" "She was kind of pissed off at me this weekend," he admits. "But we talked it out. We were good again." "I bet," I think. "Have you tried calling her friends?" "No one's seen her. Not her friends, not her teachers, and she's not the kind of person who cuts classes." We don't usually open up a missing persons case until 36 hours have passed, although that's not a hard and fast rule. The extent of the net to be cast is determined by the missing person's status, at risk or at no apparent risk. And right now, there's something about this guy, some hunch, that makes me think he's not telling me everything. "Mr. McGuire," I say, "why don't you and I take a ride?" Jess Ogilvy is doing pretty damn well for a grad student. She lives in a Tony neighborhood full of brick houses and BMWs. "How long has she lived here?" I ask. "Only a week. She's house-sitting for one of her professors, who's in Italy for the semester." We park on the street, and McGuire leads me to the back door, which isn't locked. That's not an uncommon occurrence around here. In spite of all my warnings about being safe instead of sorry, a lot of folks make the incorrect assumption that crime could not and does not happen in this town. In the mudroom, there's a melange of items, from the coat that must belong to the girl, to a walking stick, to a pair of men's boots. The kitchen is tidy, and there's a mug in the sink with a tea bag in it. "I didn't touch anything," McGuire says. "This was all here when I showed up this morning." The mail is stacked neatly in a pile on the table. A purse lies on its side, and I open it to find a wallet with $213 still in it. "Did you notice anything missing?" I ask. "Yeah," McGuire says, "upstairs." He leads me to a guest bedroom, where the drawers of a single dresser are half open, clothes spilling out of them. "She's a neat freak," he says. "She'd never leave the bed unmade or have clothes lying around the floor like this." "But this box with the gift wrap on it? It had a backpack inside that's gone now. It still had the tags on it. Her aunt got it for her for Christmas and she hated it." I walk to the closet. Inside are several dresses, as well as a few button-down men's shirts and pairs of jeans. "Those are mine," McGuire says. "You live here too?" "Not officially, as far as the professor goes. But yeah, I've been staying over most nights. Till she kicked me out, anyway."
"She kicked you out?"
"I told you, we kind of had a fight. She didn't want to talk to me on Sunday night. But Monday, we'd work things out."
"Define that," I say.
"We had sex," McGuire replies.
"Consensual?"
"Jesus, dude, what kind of guy do you think I am?"
He seems truly affronted.
"What about her makeup, her toiletries?"
"Her toothbrush is missing," McGuire says.
"But her makeup's still here. Look, shouldn't you be calling in backup or something, or posting an Amber Alert?"
I ignore him.
"Did you try contacting her parents? Where do they live?"
"I called them. They're in Bennington, and they haven't heard from her. And now they're in a panic, too."
"Great," I think. "Has she ever disappeared like this before?"
"I don't know. I've only been going out with her for a few months."
"Look," I say, "if you stick around, she'll probably call, or just come back home. Sounds to me like she needed to cool off for a while."
"You gotta be kidding me," McGuire says. "If she left on purpose, why would she forget to take her wallet, but remember her cell phone? Why would she use a backpack she couldn't wait to return for store credit?"
"I don't know. To throw you off her trail, maybe?"
McGuire's eyes flash. And I know the moment before he springs that he's going to come after me. I throw him off with one quick move that twists his arm behind his back.
"Careful," I mutter. "I could arrest you for that."
McGuire tenses in my hold.
"My girlfriend's gone missing. I pay your salary, and you won't even do your job and investigate?"
Technically, if McGuire is a student, he's not paying my salary. But I'm not about to press the point.
"Tell you what," I say, releasing him. "I'll take one more look around." I wander into the master bedroom, but clearly Jess Ogilvy hasn't been sleeping there. It's pristine. The master bathroom reveals slightly damp towels, but the shower floor is already dry. Downstairs, there's no sign of disorder in the living room.
I walk around the perimeter of the house and then check the mailbox. Inside is a note, printed from a computer, asking the postman to hold the mail until further notified. Who the hell types a note to the postman? Snapping on a pair of gloves, I slip the note into an evidence bag. I'll have the lab run a ninhydrin test for prints. Right now, my hunch is that if they don't match Jess Ogilvie's, they're going to match Mark McGuire's.
Emma. I don't know what to expect when I go into Jacob's room the next morning. He slept through the night. I checked on him every hour. But I know from past experience that he won't be expressive until those neurotransmitters aren't raging through his bloodstream anymore. I called Jess twice, on her cell and at her new residence, but only got voicemail. I've sent her an email, asking her to tell me what happened at yesterday's session, if there was anything out of the ordinary. But until I hear back from her, I have to deal with Jacob. When I peek in at 6 a.m., he's not sleeping anymore. He's sitting on his bed with his hands in his lap, staring at the wall across from him. Jacob? I say, tentatively. Honey? I walk closer and gently shake him. Jacob continues to stare at the wall in silence. I wave a hand in front of his face, but he doesn't respond. Jacob? I grab his shoulders and pull on them. He topples to the side and just lies where he's fallen. Panic climbs the ladder of my throat. Speak to me, I demand. I'm thinking catatonia. I'm thinking schizophrenia. I am thinking of all the lost places Jacob could slip to in his own mind and not return. Straddling his big body, I strike him hard enough across the face to leave a red handprint, and still he doesn't react. Don't, I say, starting to cry. Don't do this to me. There's a voice at the door. What's going on? Theo asks, his face still hazy with sleep and his hair sticking up in hedgehog spikes. In that instant, I realize that Theo might be my savior. Say something that would upset your brother, I order. He looks at me as if I'm crazy. There's something wrong with him, I explain, my voice breaking. I just want him to come back. I need to make him come back. Theo glances down at Jacob's slack body, his vacant eyes, and I can tell he's scared. But do it, Theo, I say. I think it's the quiver in my voice, not the command, which makes him agree. Tentatively, Theo leans close to Jacob. Wake up! Theo, I sigh. We both know he's holding back. You're gonna be late for school, Theo says. I watch closely, but there's no recognition in Jacob's eyes. I'm getting in the shower first, Theo adds. And then I'm gonna mess up your closet. When Jacob just stays silent, the anger Theo usually keeps hidden rolls over him like a tsunami. You freak! He shouts, so loud that Jacob's hair stirs with the force of his breath. You stupid goddamn freak! Jacob doesn't even flinch. Why can't you be normal? Theo yells, punching his brother in the chest. He hits him again, harder this time. Just be fucking normal, he cries. And I realize tears are streaming down Theo's face. For a moment, we are caught in this hell with Jacob unresponsive between us. Get me a phone, I say, and Theo turns and flies out the door. As I sink down beside Jacob, the bulk of his weight sways toward me. Theo reappears with the telephone, and I punch in the page number for Jacob's psychiatrist, Dr. Murano. She calls me back 30 seconds later, her voice still rough with sleep. Emma, she says, what's going on? I explain Jacob's meltdown last night and his catatonia this morning. And you don't know what triggered it? She asks. No, he had a meeting with his tutor yesterday. I look at Jacob. A line of drool snakes from the corner of his mouth. I called her, but she hasn't phoned me back yet. Does he look like he's in physical distress? No, I think. That would be me. I don't know. I don't think so. Is he breathing? Yes. Does he know who you are? No, I admit. And this is what really scares me. If he doesn't know who I am, how can I help him remember who he is? Tell me his vitals. I put the phone down and look at my wristwatch, make a count. His pulse is 90 and his respirations are 20. Look, Emma, the doctor says. I'm an hour away from where you are. I think you need to take him to the ER. I know what'll happen then. If Jacob's unable to snap out of this, he'll be a candidate for a 302 involuntary commitment in the hospital psych ward. After I hang up, I kneel down in front of Jacob. Baby, just give me a sign. Just show me you're on the other side. Jacob doesn't even blink. Wiping my eyes, I head to Theo's room. He's barricaded himself inside. I have to bang heavily on the door to be heard over the beat of his music. When he finally opens it, his eyes are red-rimmed and his jaw is set. I need your help moving him, I say flatly, and for once, Theo doesn't fight me. Together, we try to haul Jacob's big frame out of his bed and downstairs into the car. I take his arms, Theo takes his legs. We drag, we push, we shove. By the time we reach the mudroom door, I'm bathed in sweat and Theo's legs are bruised from where he twice stumbled under Jacob's weight. I'll get the car door, Theo says, and he runs into the driveway, his socks crunching lightly on the old snow. Together, we manage to get Jacob to the car. He doesn't even make a sound when his bare feet touch the icy driveway. We put him into the back seat head first, and then I struggle to pull him to a sitting position, practically crawling into his lap to fasten his seatbelt. With my head pressed up against Jacob's heart, I listen for the click of metal to metal.
Here's Johnny!
The words aren't his. They're Jack Nicholson's in The Shining. But it's his voice, his beautiful, tattered sandpaper voice. Jacob? I cup my hands around his face. He isn't looking at me, but then again, he never looks at me. Mom, Jacob says, my feet are really cold. I burst into tears and gather him tight in my arms. Oh, baby, I reply. Let's do something about that.
Jacob. This is where I go when I go. It's a room with no windows and no doors, and walls that are thin enough for me to see and hear everything, but too thick to break through. I'm there, but I'm not there. I am pounding to be let out, but nobody can hear me. This is where I go, when I go. To a country where everyone's face looks different from mine, and the language is the act of not speaking, and noise is everywhere in the air we breathe. I am doing what the Romans do in Rome. I am trying to communicate, but no one has bothered to tell me that these people cannot hear. This is where I go, when I go. Somewhere completely, unutterably orange. This is where I go, when I go. To the place where my body becomes a piano, full of black keys only, the sharps and the flats, When everyone knows that to play a song other people want to hear, you need some white keys. This is why I come back. To find those white keys. I'm not exaggerating when I say that my mother has been staring at me for 15 minutes. Shouldn't you be doing something else? I finally ask. Right. You're right, she says, flustered. But she doesn't actually leave. Mom, I groan. There has got to be something more fascinating than watching me eat. There's watching paint dry, for example, or watching the laundry cycle. I know that I've given her a scare today, because of what happened this morning. It's apparent in A, her inability to leave my side for more than 3 seconds, and B, her willingness to cook me Orida Crinkles fries for breakfast. She even forced Theo to take the bus today, instead of being driven into school like usual, because she didn't want to leave me at home alone and had already decided that I was going to have a sick day. Frankly, I don't understand why she's so upset when I'm the one who went missing. Frankly, I wonder who Frank was and why he has an adverb all to himself. I'm going to take a shower, I announce. Are you coming too? That finally shocks her into moving. You're sure you feel all right? Yes. I'll come up and check on you in a few minutes then. As soon as she is gone, I put the plate with the French fries on the nightstand. I am going to take a shower. I just have something to do first. I have my own fuming chamber. It used to be the home of my pet fish, Arlo, before he died. The empty fish tank sits on the top of my dresser now, inverted. Underneath the fish tank is a coffee cup warmer. I used to use a Sterno, but my mother wasn't very enthusiastic about fire, even one burning at low level, in my room, hence the electric warmer. On top of this, I make a little boat out of aluminum foil, and then I squeeze in a small nickel-sized dollop of crazy glue. I take the mug of cocoa, non-dairy, of course, my mother brought me, and stick it in the chamber, too. It'll provide humidity in the air, even though I won't want to drink it after the fuming, when white scum is floating around on its surface. Finally, I place inside the drinking glass that has a known sample on it, my test fingerprint, to make sure everything is working. There's only one thing left to do, but it makes my stomach clench. I have to force myself to sort through the clothes I was wearing yesterday to find the item I want to fume. The one I took home from her house. And that, of course, makes me think of everything else, which means the corners of my mind go black. I have to actively work not to be sucked into that hole again. Even through the latex glove I've slipped on, I can feel how cold the metal is. How cold everything was last night. In the shower, I scrub really hard, until my skin is too pink and my eyes are raw from staring into the stream of water. I remember everything, even when I don't want to. Once, when I was in third grade, a boy made fun of the way I talked. I didn't understand why his impression of me, with words falling flat as pancakes, would be funny to anyone. I didn't understand why he kept saying things like, "Take me to your leader." All I knew was that he followed me around on the playground, and everywhere he went, people would laugh at me. "What is your problem?" I finally asked, turning around to find him right on my heels. "What is your problem?" he parroted. "I'd really prefer it if you could find something else to do," I said. "I'd really prefer it if you could find something else to do." And before I knew what I was really planning, my fingers closed into a fist and punched him square in the face. There was blood everywhere. I didn't like having his blood on my hand. I didn't like having it on my shirt, which was supposed to be yellow. The boy, meanwhile, was knocked unconscious. And I was dragged to the principal's office and suspended for a week. I don't like to talk about that day. Because it makes me feel like I'm full of broken glass. I never thought I'd see that much blood again on my hands. But I was wrong. It only takes 10 minutes for the cyanoacrylate, the crazy glue, to properly work. The monomers in its vapors polymerize in the presence of water. Amines, amides, hydroxyl, and carboxylic acid, all of which happen to be found in the oils left by fingerprints. They stick to those oils, creating a latent image, which can be made more visible by dusting with powder. Then, the image can be photographed and resized and compared to the known sample. There's a knock on my door. You okay in there? No, I'm hanging from a closet rod, I say. This is not the truth. That's not funny, Jacob, my mother replies. Fine, I'm getting dressed. This is not the truth either. I am actually wearing my underwear and a t-shirt right now. Okay, she says. Well, give a holler when you're done. I wait until her footsteps fade down the hall, and then I remove the glass from beneath the fish tank. Sure enough, there are several prints. I dust them with a dual-use powder, which has contrast on both white and black surfaces. Then I dust the prints on the second item, too. I photograph them at close range with the digital camera I got for Christmas 2 years ago, and load the images into my computer. It's always a good idea to photograph your latent prints prior to lifting them, just in case you destroy them during the process. Later, in Adobe Photoshop, I can invert the colors of the ridges and resize the prints. I can begin an analysis. I carefully tape over the print to preserve it, intending to hide what I took away from her house in a place where no one will ever find it. My mother, by then, is tired of waiting. She opens the door. Jacob, put on a pair of pants! She holds her hand over her eyes, but enters my bedroom all the same. No one told you to come in, I say. She sniffs. You've been using crazy glue again, haven't you? I told you I don't want you fuming while you're in the room. That can't be good for you. She pauses. Then again, if you're fuming, you must be feeling better. I don't say anything. Is that your cocoa in there? Yes, I say. She shakes her head. Come on downstairs, my mother sighs. I'll make you a fresh cup. Here are some facts about forensics. 1. Forensics is defined as the scientific methods and techniques used in connection with the detection of crime. 2. The word forensic comes from the Latin forensis, which means before the forum. In Roman times, a criminal charge was presented in front of a public group in the forum. The accused and the victim would give testimony, and the one who had the best argument would win. 3. The first written account of forensics to solve cases was during the Song Dynasty in China in 1248. After a person was killed with a sickle, an investigator told everyone to bring their sickles to a specified location, and when the flies were drawn to one by the smell of blood, the murderer confessed. 4. The earliest incidence of fingerprint use to determine identity was in the 7th century, when a debtor's fingerprints were attached to a bill as proof of the debt for the lender. 5. Forensic science is a lot easier to perform when you aren't personally involved. The tips of your fingers, the palms of your hands, and the soles of your feet aren't smooth. They are friction-ridged skin, series of lines with contours and shapes, like a topographical map. Along those lines are sweat pores, and if they become contaminated with sweat, ink, blood, or dirt, they'll leave a reproduction of those lines on the object that's been touched. Or, in less fancy terms, a fingerprint. If the print can be seen, it can be photographed. If it can be photographed, it can be preserved and compared to a known sample. It's an art as much as it's a science. Since I don't have an APHIS terminal in my house to scan the latent print and spit out 50 candidates with matching similarities, I have to rely on the naked eye. The goal is to find 10 to 12 similarities between the known sample and the latent print, That's what most examiners would conclude to be a match. On my computer screen, I set images of the two prints. I place my cursor on the core, the centermost part of the print. I mark a delta, a small triangular formation, to the left of the core. I note ending ridges and bifurcations and a circular whorl. A bifurcation, then two ridges, then another bifurcation downward. Just like I assumed. This is a match. That makes me feel like I'm going to throw up, but I swallow and force myself to do what needs to be done. Like yesterday. Shaking my head clear, I take a small Tupperware container that I've filched from the kitchen and place the evidence inside. Then I rummage around in my closet until I find Jemima Puddle Duck. She's a stuffed animal that I used to sleep with when I was a kid, and because she's white, she's up on a shelf above the rest of my clothes that have actual pigmentation. I place her face down in my lap and, using a box cutter, make an incision in the place where she might have had a heart. The Tupperware has to be jammed inside, and it makes Jemima look like she has an unsightly rib cage, but it works. I suture her with the same thread I used last week to fix a hole in my sock. I'm not very good at it. I stick myself nearly every stitch, but I get the job done. Then I take out a notebook and start writing. When I'm done, I lie down on my bed. I wish I were at school. It's harder when I'm not working at something. "I shot the sheriff," I whisper, "but I swear it was in self-defense." I've often thought about how a person could commit the perfect crime. Everyone always talks about the proverbial icicle, stab someone and the murder weapon will melt. But it's a long shot, A, that you will be able to grip that icicle long enough to inflict a wound, and B, that it won't break off when it hits the skin before puncturing it. Mescaline sprinkled over someone's salad would be subtler, the brown powder would be virtually indistinguishable mixed with vinaigrette, and you wouldn't taste the bitter flavor, especially if there was chicory or arugula in the mix. But what if you only made the victim have a bad trip instead of die? And plus, where would you get your stash? You could take someone sailing and shove him overboard, preferably after getting him drunk, and say he fell accidentally. But then you would need to have a boat. A mix of Vicodin and alcohol would slow the heart excessively, but your victim would have to pretty much be a party animal for a detective to not find that suspicious. I've heard of people who try to burn down a house after committing murder, but that never really works. The arson inspectors can trace where the fire started. Plus, a body has to be charred beyond recognition and dental work to not point a finger back at you. I wouldn't recommend anything that leaves blood, either. It's messy. You'll need lots of bleach to clean it. And there's bound to still be a drop left behind. The conundrum of the perfect crime is complicated, because getting away with murder has very little to do with the mechanism of the killing, and everything to do with what you do before and after. The only way to really cover a crime is to not tell a soul. Not your wife, not your mother, not your priest. And, of course, you have to have killed the right kind of person. Someone who isn't going to be looked for. Someone who nobody wants to see again.
Theo. Once, a girl came up to me in the cafeteria and asked me if I wanted to go to Jesus camp. "You will be saved," she told me. And man, I was tempted. I mean, it's been pretty clear to me for a while that I'm going to hell, because of all the secret thoughts I'm not supposed to have about Jacob. You always read these books about kids who have autistic siblings and who are constantly looking out for them, who love them to death, who do a better job diffusing their tantrums than the adults. Well, I'm not one of those people. Sure, when Jacob used to wander off, I'd feel sick in the pit of my stomach. But it wasn't because I was worried about him. It was because I had to be an awful brother to be thinking what I was. Maybe he'll never be found, and I can get on with my life. I used to have dreams that my brother was normal. You know, that we could fight about ordinary things, like whose turn it was to control the television remote, or who got to ride shotgun in the car. But I was never allowed to fight with Jacob. Not when I'd forget to lock my bedroom door and he came in and stole my CDs for some forensics project. Not when we were little, and he'd walk around the table at my birthday party eating cake off the plates of my friends. My mother said it was a house rule, and she explained it like this. Jacob's different from the rest of us. Gee, you think? And by the way, since when does being different net you a free pass in life? The problem is, Jacob's difference doesn't confine itself to Jacob. It's like the time my mother's red shirt bled in the wash and turned all my clothes pink. My brother's Asperger's has made me different, too. I could never have friends over, because what if Jacob had a meltdown? If I thought it was weird to see my brother peeing on the heater to watch steam rise, what the hell would someone from school think? That I was a freak, no doubt, by association. True confession number one. When I'm walking down the hall in school, and I see Jacob at the other end of the corridor, I intentionally divert my path to avoid him. True confession number two. Once, when a bunch of kids from another school started making fun of Jacob as he attempted to play kickball, a hot mess, if there ever was one, I pretended that I didn't know him. I laughed along, too. True confession number three. I truly believe that I have it worse than Jacob, because he's oblivious most of the time to the fact that people want nothing to do with him. But I am 100% aware that they're all looking at me and thinking, oh, that's the bizarre kid's brother. True confession number four. I don't sit around thinking about having kids, normally, but when I do, it scares the shit out of me. What if my own son winds up being like Jacob? I've already spent my whole childhood dealing with autism. I don't know if I can handle doing it for the rest of my life. Anytime I think of one of these things, I feel like crap. I'm pretty much useless. Not Jacob's parent, and not one of his teachers. I'm just here as the benchmark alternative, so that my mother can look from Jacob to me and measure the distance between an AS kid and a so-called normal one. When that girl asked me to go to Jesus camp, I asked her if Jesus was going to be there. She looked confused, and then said no. Well, I said, isn't that a little like going to hockey camp and not playing hockey? As I walked away, the girl told me Jesus loved me. How do you know? I asked. Once, after Jacob had raged through my room like a tropical storm and destroyed most of what was important to me, my mother came in to commiserate. Deep down, he loves you, she told me. How do you know? I asked. I don't, she admitted. But it's what I have to believe to keep going. I've looked at my jacket, my pants, I've scoured the driveway, but I can't find the iPod, and that means it's lost somewhere between here and her house. What if she knows I tried to take it? What if she tells someone? By the time I get home from school, life is back to normal. My mother is typing away on her laptop at the kitchen table, and Jacob is in his room with the door closed. I make myself ramen noodles and eat them in my room with Coldplay blasting as I do my French homework. My mother's always telling me I can't listen to music when I do my homework. Once, she barged in and accused me of not working on my English paper when it was what I'd been doing all along. How good could it possibly be, she said, if you're not concentrating? I told her to sit down and read the stupid paper on my computer. She did, and shut up pretty quickly. I got an A on that project, as I recall. I guess that somehow the gene pool in our family got all mixed up, and as a result, Jacob can only focus on one thing, an extreme obsession, while I can do 16,000 things at a time. When I finish my homework, I'm still hungry, so I go downstairs. My mother is nowhere to be found, and there's no freaking food in the house, for a change. Not. But I notice Jacob sitting in the living room. I look up at the clock, but I hardly have to. If it's 4:30 in our house, it must be Crime Busters. I hesitate at the doorway, watching him pore over his notebooks. Half of me is ready to slink away without being seen by Jacob, but the other half remembers what he looked like this morning. In spite of all I've said about wishing he was never born, seeing him like that, like the light had gone out inside him, sort of, made me feel like I'd been punched over and over in the gut. What if I'd been born first and was the one who wound up with Asperger's? Would he be standing here, wishing I wouldn't notice him too? Before I can even let myself get good and guilty, Jacob starts talking. He doesn't look at me. He never does. But that probably means all his other senses are more finely tuned. "It's episode 22 today," he says, as if we've been in the middle of a conversation. "An oldie but a goodie." "How many times have you seen this one?" I ask. He glances down at his notebook. 38. I'm not a huge fan of Crime Busters. In the first place, I think the acting is bad. In the second place, this has to be the richest CSI lab ever with all its bells and whistles. Something tells me that the fuming chamber at the state lab in Vermont looks a lot more like Jacob's duct-taped old fish tank than the Crime Busters version, which is jazzed up with blue neon lights and lots of chrome. Plus, the investigators seem to spend a lot more time figuring out who's going to jump into bed with whom than they do solving crimes. All the same, I sit down next to my brother on the couch. There's a good foot of space between us, because Jacob isn't crazy about being touched. I know better than to talk when the show is on. Instead, I limit my editorial comments to the moments when there are commercials for erectile dysfunction drugs and OxyClean. The storyline involves a girl who's found dead after a hit and run. There's a paint scrape on her scooter, so the sexy CSI takes it to the lab. Meanwhile, the dude who does the autopsies finds a bruise on the girl's body that looks like a fingerprint. The crusty old CSI photographs it and takes it to the lab and gets a hit. Some retired government employee who's drinking his prune juice and using a clapper when Crusty and Sexy show up. They ask him if he's had a car accident lately, and he says that his car was stolen. Unfortunately for him, the CSIs find it parked in the attached garage. Caught red-handed, he admits that he was driving and that his foot hit the accelerator instead of the brake. When Sexy examines the car, though, she finds the driver's seat pushed back too far for the old man's height, and the stereo set to hip-hop. Sexy asks if anyone else drives Grandpa's car just as a teenage boy enters. Gramps admits that after hitting the girl on her scooter, he banged his head so his grandson drove him home. Needless to say, no one believes him. But it's his word against theirs until Krusty finds a piece of tooth lodged in the steering wheel, which gets matched to the grandson. The kid's arrested, and his grandfather gets released. The whole time I'm watching this, Jacob is scribbling away in his notebooks. He has shelves full of them, all filled with crime scenarios that aired on this TV show. "What do you write down in there?" I ask. Jacob shrugs. "The evidence. Then I try to deduce what will happen." "But you've seen this one 38 times, I say. "You already know how it's going to turn out." Jacob's pen keeps scratching across the page. "But maybe it'll end differently this time," he says. "Maybe today, the kid won't get caught."
Rich. On Thursday morning, my phone rings. "Matson," I say, answering. "The CDs are in alphabetical order." I frown at the unfamiliar voice. Sounds like some kind of speakeasy password. "The CDs are in alphabetical order, and the bluebird wears fishnet stockings. And just like that, you get entry into the inner sanctum. I beg your pardon, I say. Whoever took Jess hung around long enough to alphabetize the CDs. Now I recognize the voice, Mark McGuire. I assume your girlfriend hasn't returned yet, I say. Would I be calling you if she had? I clear my throat. Tell me what you noticed. I dropped a handful of change on the carpet this morning, and when I picked it up, I realized that the tower that holds the CDs had been moved. There was a little sunken spot in the carpet, you know? Right, I say. So these professors, they've got hundreds of CDs, and they keep them in this four-sided tower that spins. Anyway, I noticed that all the W's were organized together. Richard Wagner, Dionne Warwick, Dinah Washington, The Who, John Williams, Mary Lou Williams, and then Lester Young, Johann Zumsteck. They listened to The Who? I looked on all four sides, and every single CD is in order. Is it possible they always were, and you didn't notice? I ask. No, because last weekend, when Jess and I were looking for some decent music to listen to, they sure as hell didn't look that way. Mr. McGuire, I say, let me call you right back. Wait, it's been 2 days now. I hang up and pinch the bridge of my nose. Then I dial the state lab and talk to Iris, a grandmother type who has a little crush on me, which I milk when I need my evidence processed fast. Iris, I say, how's the prettiest girl in the lab?
I'm the only girl in the lab, she laughs. You calling about your mailbox note?
Yeah.
Came up clean, no prints at all.
I thank her and hang up the phone. It figures that a perp who alphabetizes CDs is smart enough to wear gloves while leaving a note. We probably won't get any prints off the computer keyboard either. On the other hand, the spices might be organized by indigenous regions. If Mark McGuire is involved with his girlfriend's disappearance and wants to lead us on a very different profiling track, he might conceivably alphabetize CDs. The least likely thing I'd ever expect of Mark McGuire. Which could also explain why it took him 24 more hours to do it. In any case, I'm going to take a look at those CDs myself, and the contents of Jess Ogilvie's purse, and anything else that might indicate where she is and why she's there. I stand up and grab my jacket, heading past dispatch to tell them where I'm going, when one of the desk sergeants pulls at my sleeve. This here's Detective Mattson, he says.
Good, another man barks. Now I know who to get the chief to fire.
Behind him, a woman in tears twists the leather straps of her handbag. I'm sorry, I say, smiling politely. I didn't catch your name.
Claude Ogilvie, he replies. State Senator Claude Ogilvie.
Senator, we're doing everything we can to find your daughter.
I find that hard to believe, he says, when you haven't even had anyone in this department investigating it.
As a matter of fact, Senator, I was just on my way to your daughter's residence.
I assume, of course, that you're meeting the rest of the police force there, because I certainly wouldn't want to find out that 2 whole days had gone by without this police department taking my daughter's disappearance seriously.
I cut him off mid-sentence by taking his arm and propelling him toward my office. With all due respect, Senator, I prefer it if you didn't tell me how to do my own job.
I damn well will tell you whatever I want, whenever I want, until my daughter is brought back safe and sound.
I ignore him and offer a chair to his wife. Mrs. Ogilvie, I say, has Jess tried to contact you at all? She shakes her head.
And I can't call her. Her voicemail box is full.
The senator shakes his head. That's because that idiot McGuire kept leaving messages.
Has she ever run away before? I ask.
No, she'd never do that.
Has she been upset lately? Worried about anything?
Mrs. Ogilvy shakes her head. She was so excited about moving into that house. Said it beat out the dorms any day.
How about her relationship with her boyfriend? At that, Senator Ogilvy stays blissfully, stonily silent. His wife spares him a quick glance.
There's no accounting for love, she says.
If he hurt her, Ogilvy mutters, if he laid a finger on her, then we will find out about it and we will take care of it, I smoothly interject. The first priority, though, is locating Jess.
Mrs. Ogilvy leans forward. Her eyes are red-rimmed.
Do you have a daughter, detective? She asks.
Once, at a fairground, Sasha and I were walking through the midway when a rowdy group of teenagers barreled between us, breaking the bond between our hands. I tried to keep my eye on her, but she was tiny, and when the group was gone, so was Sasha. I found myself standing in the middle of the fairground, turning in circles and screaming her name, while all around me rides spun in circles and wisps of cotton candy flew from their metal wheels onto a spool, and the roar of chainsaws splitting through wood announced the lumberjack contest. When I finally found her, petting the nose of a Jersey calf in a 4-H barn, I was so relieved that my legs gave out. I literally fell to my knees. I haven't even responded, but Mrs. Ogilvy puts her hand on her husband's arm.
See, I told you, Claude, she murmurs. He understands.
Jacob. The sensory break room at school has a swing hanging from the ceiling. It's made of rope and stretchy blue material, and when you sit inside it, it wraps you like a cocoon. You can pull the sides closed so that you can't see out and no one can see in, and spin in circles. There are also mats with different textures, wind chimes, a fan. There's a fiber optic lamp that has hundreds of points of light that change from green to purple to pink. There are sponges and koosh balls and brushes and bubble wrap and weighted blankets. There's a noise machine that only an aide is allowed to turn on, and you can choose to listen to waves or rain or white noise or a jungle. There's a bubble tube about 3 feet tall with plastic fish that move in lazy circles. In school, part of my IEP is a cool-off pass, a COP. If I need to, at any time, even during an exam, my teachers will allow me to leave the classroom. Sometimes the outside world gets a little too tight for me, and I need a place to relax. I can come to the sensory break room, but the truth is, I hardly ever do. The only kids who use the sensory break room are special needs, and walking through the door, I might as well just slap a big fat label on myself that says I'm not normal. So most of the time when I need a break, I wander around the hallways. Sometimes I go to the cafeteria to get a bottle of vitamin water. The best flavor? Focus. Kiwi, strawberry, with vitamin A and lutein for clarity. The worst? Essential. Orange, orange. Need I say more? Sometimes I hang out in the teacher's room, playing chess with Mr. Pakiri or helping Mrs. Leatherwood, the school secretary, stuff envelopes. But these past 2 days, when I leave my classroom, I head right for that sensory break room. The aide who staffs the room, Ms. Agworth, is also the quiz bowl teacher. Every day at 11:45, she leaves to make photocopies of whatever it is she's using in quiz bowl later that day. For this very reason, I've made it a point to use my COP pass at 11:30 for the past 2 days. It gets me out of English, which is a blessing in disguise, since we are reading Flowers for Algernon. And just last week, a girl asked, not in a mean way, but truly curious, whether there were any experiments underway that might cure people like me. Today, I enter the sensory break room and make a beeline for the koosh balls. Holding one in each hand, I wrestle my way into the swing and pull the material closed around me. "Morning, Jacob," Ms. Agworth says. "You need anything?" Not right now, I murmur. I don't know why people with AS are so sensitive to things like texture and color and sound and light. When I don't look someone in the eye, and when other people very pointedly look away from me so they don't appear to be staring, I sometimes wonder if I even really exist. The items in this room are the sensory equivalent of the game Battleship. Instead of calling out coordinates, B4, D7, I call for another physical sensation. Each time I feel the weight of a blanket on my arm or the pop of bubble wrap under my body when I roll on it, it's a direct hit. And at the end of my sensory break, instead of sinking my battleship, I've just found a way to locate myself in the grid of this world. I close my eyes and slowly spin inside this dark, close ball. "Pay no attention to the man behind the curtain," I murmur. "What's that, Jacob?" Miss Agworth says. "Nothing," I shout. I wait until I've swung in 3 more slow pivots, and then I emerge. "How are you doing today?" she asks. It seems like a pretty gratuitous question, given the fact that I wouldn't be in this room if I were able to tolerate sitting in class like neurotypical people. But when I don't answer, she doesn't pry. She just keeps reading her trivia books and jotting down notes. The largest fish in the world is a whale shark at 50 feet. 4 million marshmallow peeps are made each day. That sort of makes me wonder who on earth is buying them when it's not Easter. It takes the average adult man 13 minutes to eat his dinner. "I've got one for you, Ms. Agworth," I say. "The word ass is in the Bible 170 times. "Thanks for that, Jacob, but it's not really appropriate." She shuffles her papers and looks down at her watch. "You think you'd be okay for a few minutes if I ran down to the office to make some copies?" Technically, she is not supposed to leave me alone. And I know there are certain other autistic kids who use the sensory room that she'd never stop watching like a hawk. Matilda, for example, would probably fashion a noose out of the rope on the swing. Charlie would start tearing the shelves off the walls. But me, I'm a pretty safe bet. "No problem, Ms. A," I say. In fact, I'm counting on it. At the moment the door closes behind her again, I pull the cell phone out of my pocket. As soon as I flip it open and press the power button, it lights up, little blue squares around each number, and a picture of Jess and Mark on the screensaver. I cover Mark's face with my thumb. It's Thursday, and today I'm allowed to call her. I already broke the rules and called her twice before from this phone, dialing her own cell number, even though I knew I would be automatically dumped into voicemail. "Hey, so this is Jess, and you know what to do." I am already starting to forget the notes in the song of her voice. Today, though, instead of hearing her message, I heard a tinny voice telling me that this wireless customer's mailbox is full. I'm prepared for this. I have memorized the phone number she gave me a week ago, the one that belongs to the new house. I dial it, even though I have to do it twice because it's unfamiliar and the numbers get tangled in my head. A machine picks up. "Hey, this is Jess at the Robertson's house. They're out of town, but you can leave a message for me." I hang up and dial it again. "Hey, this is Jess at the Robertson's house." I wait till the beep, and then I hang up. I turn off the power button on the cell phone, too. Then I speak my message, the same words I say to her every Thursday. "See you in 3 days."
Emma. By Thursday, Jacob looks like the old Jacob, but he still isn't back to normal. I can tell by the way he's distracted. I'll set a full dinner plate down in front of him, and he won't eat until I remind him that it's time to pick up his fork and dig in. And by the moments I catch him rocking or bouncing on the balls of his feet. His meds don't seem to be helping. And I've heard from teachers at his school that he's been spending nearly half the day in the sensory break room. I've called Jess Ogilvy twice, but her voicemail box is full. I'm afraid to bring her name up to Jacob, but I don't know what else to do. So after dinner on Thursday, I knock on the door of his bedroom and let myself inside. "Hi," I say. He looks up from a book he's reading. "Hey." It took me 2 years to realize that Jacob hadn't learned to read along with the rest of his kindergarten class. His teacher said he was among the most gifted language arts students, and sure enough, every night, he would pick out a book from a big basket in his room and read it aloud. But one day, I realized that what everyone assumed was reading was actually just Jacob's photographic memory. If he'd heard the book once, he could spit it back. "Read this," I had said, handing him a Dr. Seuss book, and he'd opened it up and started the story. I'd stopped him, pointing to a letter. "What's that?" "A bee." "And what sound does a bee make?" He hesitated. "Buzz," he said. Now I sit down beside him on the bed. "How are you feeling?" "Interrupted," Jacob says. I take the book out of his hands. "Can we talk?" He nods. "Did you and Jess have a fight on Tuesday?" "No." "When you went to her house, she didn't say anything to upset you?" He shakes his head.